This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer. Live your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We had a special look at childhood anxiety. We know that, well, rates have been through the roof over the course of the pandemic and routine has been put to blame. And to be honest with you, more to do with lack of routine. One Dubai-based child psychologist is aiming to put this to rights with some products, some ideas, and she was on hand to answer your question around anxiety in children, from terrible drop-offs to teens under stress. And staying with children and education, when should you be worried about their handwriting? Is it a sign of being lazy or careless, or can it be a sign that perhaps developmentally they need a bit of love and attention? We were speaking to Judith Wethler. She's from Hope Habilitation Centre, decades of experience when it comes to helping children get the help they need. And we went into the great outdoors as well, speaking to the operations manager of Emirates Biofarm. What could you be growing this half term with your kids? And meeting an inspirational 16-year-old, Veha Kedia, has turned her attentions and her time towards an inspirational family member. Her uncle has been paralysed since the age of 8, and he is the subject of a documentary she's producing in order to raise awareness. And be honest, have you steered your children towards or away from certain toys because of their gender? Lego is on a mission to get more girls building, finding out more about the role models and the message behind Girls Are Ready.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
And we are discussing anxiety in children today, and driven by the impact of the pandemic on children's mental health, Dr. Elena Andriotti, a Dubai-based psychologist, decided to tackle that exact issue. And she's created an approachable, friendly character called Dr. Feelings and a series of routine cards for toddlers, preschoolers and school-aged children. They're in English and Arabic. We're learning more about that more. Dr. Elena, thank you so much for being with us today, especially during half term. I know you were a mum of three, and it's no doubt a busy week. And thank you for really shining the light on a topic that I think a lot of parents have become perhaps more aware of than ever before. Can you explain a little bit about what role lack of routine has had on children over the course of the pandemic, which has been ticking on for about 18 months now?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Helen. It's my pleasure to be here. Well, basically, the effect on the pandemic on children has been major, and we've seen this in the clinic practice and outside of the clinic practice. Children have been struggling with what they expect from the world nowadays because of the changes that they've been through in the past couple of months or years. This said, this lack of predictability, so as to what will happen during their days, during their weeks and months, has led to an increase of anxiety, in the experience of anxiety. And this is what basically led me to develop these tools to help parents give children the routine that they need, the predictability that they need, using these visuals to help them cope with their anxiety, because anxiety as a mental health issue has a big impact on the routines that children have, in that it disrupts it big time. So once this is disrupted, it's important for us to kind of find creative ways to bring it back and to help our children get the sense of safety and security to know what to expect on a regular basis.
I think the difficult thing is none of us have known what to expect on a regular basis. You know, last week we got that email saying, 2 days of distance learning before half term. And I was like, oh, for goodness sake, I thought those days were behind us. Or, you know, people having holidays booked and then changed, or people coming in and out of our lives because of job changes or, you know, instability. And, you know, this has been hugely challenging for adults. Of course, it's been incredibly challenging for, children that we might deem as neurotypical. When we start talking about children on the autism spectrum, that's even more disruptive, because those ideas of routines and milestones and anchors are so relied upon. So any kind of routine that we can help our children with, I think, is going to be beneficial. But before we start talking about routine and coming to some of the messages we've had on 4001, Dr. Lena, I wondered if you could explain a little bit about what anxiety looks like in children, because it's become a word that we use so often and perhaps diminish a little bit in adults. You know, oh, I've got anxiety, or I'm an anxious person. But when we're talking about children in particular, what are some of the characteristics or behaviours that we need to be alerted to?
Of course. Well, the first thing is, when we talk about anxiety, we are talking about an excessive worry, an experience of worry, and a difficulty to control this worry. And this worry comes with a list of various symptoms, of which changes in the child's sleep, in appetite. It can go both ways, excessive amount of sleep or lack of sleep, eating more than usual or eating less. It has an impact on concentration as well. It can lead to aggressive behavioral and irritability as well. A lot of children report experiencing physical symptoms that can range from stomach aches, headaches, pain in the arms or legs. And of course, those symptoms don't have any physiological cause to that. So those are the major issues that we see. But mainly, we see this change in mood and this experience of worry and rushing thoughts in those children, and a difficulty for them to make sense of these thoughts. And of course, this anxiety leads to all of the changes that we just described. And it can have an impact in the academic environment as well, in the activities that they usually enjoy, and that the children won't be enjoying them as much. Mm-hmm. The tip that I always tell parents is, you know your child more than anybody else. So if you notice some changes in their behavior, it's always, you know, cause for concern. And it's important for you to kind of note down those changes and try to see what's going on with your child.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Sundays, we look at children's health, education, parenting, and having a special look at anxiety in children this hour. Delighted to be joined live on the line by Dr. Feelings herself, also known as Dr. Lena Andriotti, a Dubai-based psychologist who has come up with some routine cards to help children overcome anxiety in wake of total lack of certainty as a result of the pandemic. Dr. Lena, I wanted you, before we go to the text line, as I said, we've had many messages on 4001, people just generally quite concerned and looking for some reassurances and maybe some action points really for their children. But before we go to those messages on 4001, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about those cards. What do they look like and how do they actually work in practice?
Okay, well, basically, the cards are 15 by 15 centimeters, so they're quite large and easy for those little hands to grasp. They have some really nice visuals on it, and basically the child doesn't need to read to actually know what to do with the cards, and that there are drawings that would explain to the child what he or she needs to do. They're divided into morning, afternoon, and evening cards, and they include various different techniques and recommendations as to what children can do during these different times of the day. So the morning ones would include things like making your bed, some quiet play to start off the day, having breakfast, etc. In the afternoon, we would include a mixture of free play versus structured play. And of course, the cards always include some time for tender love and care, time with the parents, family time, etc.
I'm glad you said that. I was like, oh, these kids just sound like getting lots of chores to do. So it's a mix of, as you say, some cuddles, but also some things that, you know, they've got some roles and responsibilities around the home as well. Now, I obviously work in the afternoons, and I wondered what kind of provision you have for working parents. They can still feel involved in their children's routine if they're not in the home. Dr. Lena, can you explain that angle if it's possible?
Well, basically, the afternoon routine cards do just that. They are very helpful for working parents in that you could basically get that part of the cards to your children, give them to them and tell them that they could do that when you are away and at work. And you could choose a few of the cards, let's say the one that includes a free play, and you can choose the type of play that your child will be doing. You can even start off this activity and then the child will finish it off by the time you get home. Same goes for the structured play. It can be, let's say, a puzzle that you can start off in the morning that your child can finish off. So the cards will actually help the caregiver that is at home in helping your children, but it will also help you as a parent to know what your child is going to be doing during those hours where you are away.
Thank you, Dr. Lena.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're having a look at anxiety in children today, and many of you getting in touch with some, well, red flags that you might have noticed in terms of behaviour, and often wanting a bit of reassurance and maybe some treatment ideas as well. And we couldn't have a better person on the line to answer those. Dr. Eleni Andriotti is a Dubai-based psychologist. She's a mum of three as well and is tackling the issue of childhood anxiety. She's created Dr. Feelings, a character and a series of routine cards for children aged toddler up to school age in English and Arabic to help build in some routine during even these uncertain times. You can join the conversation, ask your questions anonymously, of course, if you prefer, on 4001. Dr. Lena, I want to go to the text line. As I said, many people getting in touch, and I think the idea of anxiety in children certainly wasn't something that my parents were kind of talking about either amongst themselves or amongst friends, 30 years ago. And it's not saying it's a modern phenomenon, but it's certainly something we're more aware of now. And hopefully we can help out everyone who's got in touch on 4001. Misha is saying, my 8-year-old son is suffering from anxiety and claustrophobia. His school are being fantastic, but I was wondering if you could tell us about what treatment could look like, because I really don't want him in a formal clinical setting. And I think that kind of busting these ideas about what treatment for children can look like is really helpful, because that can often be one of the reasons people don't seek help, because they don't want their child in that kind of hospital environment. So for an 8-year-old, what could treatment for anxiety look like, Dr. Lena?
Well, the first thing that we need to pay attention in that situation is to make sure that the anxiety is currently controlled, that it's not having a big impact as to what the child's daily life is actually like. The most important thing that we need to do right now is to teach the child the appropriate coping strategies and skills to cope with his anxiety, which is something that would be similar to what we do as adults when we try to cope with our own worries and our own stress and our own experience of anxiety. Things like exercise, breathing techniques, meditation, yoga. There are so many different techniques that can actually be taught in therapy, or using different techniques that are even available, like in resources that you will find online. And actually, the Dr. Feelings brand has recently launched 30 coping skills and mechanisms in a box for children in both English and Arabic, where you can basically have a look at the different breathing techniques, meditation, and they're all basically, the 30 techniques are all evidence-based techniques that have been shown to have a very big positive impact in reducing anxiety. But my biggest tip would be that if you notice that the child is really struggling and having trouble controlling this anxiety, a technique called cognitive behavioral therapy that would be done in a clinic practice has been shown to be very helpful as well. And I would recommend that you seek help from a professional if you find the need to, and if none of these techniques that are external basically are leading to the appropriate results.
Misha's saying there, you know, son is 8. When can children start to regulate their emotions and use coping strategies, actually understand why they're doing them and looking for those desired results? Because when I think about my 4-year-old, there is no chance that sitting her down to do some mindfulness would make any difference to a tantrum or anger or feeling overwhelmed or, you know, tears at drop off. When does that part of the brain develop where that self-regulation and awareness can actually kick in, Dr. Lena?
Actually, the techniques are adapted for younger children. So meditation techniques would be adapted for a 4-year-old. You would be surprised, but you can actually start teaching them really, really early on. So preschool years, they can actually start learning breathing techniques, techniques like the elevator. One of them is where you basically hold your hand and go up and down with the elevator. You go up to the 4th floor, you go back down to basically complete one full breath with a pause. Other techniques would include using various different animals, let's say, to describe a certain emotion. So when the dog comes in, let's say, it would be an explanation that the anxiety is here or that the fear is here. The star-shaped breathing technique is another one that's included actually in our box. And basically, it's a technique that also helps complete full breaths. Progressive muscle relaxation as well, that is helpful for adults, can even be adapted to children by teaching them techniques like holding a lemon and squeezing onto that lemon really tightly and then releasing to let go of that stress. So you would be surprised, but actually all of these techniques can be adapted to different age groups. And a lot of these techniques, you can even try them yourself and see if they work on adults as well. And you would be surprised, but we should start early on, because, I mean, an 8-year-old is very capable of doing the techniques and more, but if you start at the age of 4 or 5 or even 3 for that matter, you would be surprised, but they actually catch on and they would be able to start. And it requires a very short attention to do them.
Well, we've got a severe lack of attention in our household, so I'm definitely willing to give it a try. And H has been in touch saying, thank you for this. My son is in year 2 and cries every morning before school. Drop off is torture and I cry in the car on my way to work. Nothing seems to soothe him when I'm saying goodbye and he has to be wrenched from me by the TA. Apparently he's fine within half an hour. Please help. Would love to start afresh after the holidays. H, honestly, my heart goes out to you. It honestly, honestly does. I have been there and there's something about a painful, tearful drop-off at school or nursery that just sets the whole tone for the day as a parent. And it's a horrible feeling. It really, really is. We're in half term now, Dr. Lane, and I wondered if there is anything you would suggest to H and his or her son to try when school goes back next week.
Well, the first thing I would say is try to make sure that your anxiety is in check. Mm-hmm. Make sure that, you know, because it says in the message that this person has been crying after the drop-off. And I know it's very, very difficult, but you said something really important. Half an hour in, the child is fine. So this shows that eventually the child is learning how to adapt. And actually, you will probably notice after the holidays an increase of that behavior. And the reason for that is that it's been a couple of days since the child hasn't been doing that. And we know that one of the best things to reduce the anxiety is actually to expose the child to the stimulus that is leading to the anxiety. So it's normal for there to be an increase. You need to be prepared for that and cope with your own anxiety first so that your child will notice that you are basically at ease when you drop him or her off. It's a very, very common problem, especially in year 2. So children are really young. They've been in confinement for a really long time with the, you know, back to school / back to e-learning online, going there face to face. It's been really, really tough. So it's really hard for them to adjust. I would recommend giving him at least him or her 2 to 3 weeks to adjust after the break. And just be consistent with what you do every single day. Talk to teachers, talk to school personnel to see, is there a school counselor as well that can help? What can you do to maybe have a show and tell activity where your child can take something from home and show it to his classmates and teachers? As a team, they will be able to give you as well recommendations because they know the child very well since they spend long amounts of time with the child.
Thank you, Dr. Lena. And H, you are far from alone in this. It is really, really common, especially, as Dr. Lena said, during this time where parents and kids have been together a lot for distance learning. And, you know, we joke about how awful it was at times, but it did mean time together. And that adjustment of being back in the classroom can feel all the more stark. So, yeah, really, I'm thinking of you. And Bilal, thank you for this message on 4001. A really interesting one saying, I'm not sure if this is anxiety, but a child in my daughter's FS2 class has selective mutism. I would love to understand more. Can you tell us a little bit about this? Is this something that's born out of anxiety or is it something else entirely, Dr. Lena?
Well, to be honest with you, Helen, this is so common lately. I have been seeing so many cases of selective mutism. I consult for schools in the UAE, and selective mutism is something that we've been seeing pop out in younger aged children, particularly. And it's very common whereby the child basically decides in a social setting or situation not to be, not to engage with anyone, to be basically nonverbal, non-vocal, and to basically not engage with the adults particularly. That's a very common thing we've been seeing. Yes, it can be strongly related to anxiety, to a severe form of anxiety. What's important here is to be able to have a full history of the child and understand exactly what is happening, why this is happening. Is the child experiencing other forms of anxiety as well, other symptoms? But it seems to be something that I've been seeing a lot lately. I would definitely recommend for the person who wrote the message, so his child, to approach that particular child, because quite often we've been noticing that the children are choosing to speak to the other children, mm-hmm. Versus going towards the adults. So it's important for the kids to understand that this is very common and to understand that they can be part of the facilitators in helping with this issue. It's definitely related to anxiety.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I think that I would imagine that being a very easy situation unfolding, that because of that lack of interaction and talking, that child would then become more isolated. So for other classmates to engage in whatever the way they can, I'm sure would be hugely helpful for that child, but also for the teacher as well in terms of bridging that gap. It's fascinating you're saying it's on the rise, or certainly being more reported, something perhaps we need to look at more in the future.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Delighted to be joined on the line now by Dr. Elena Andriotti. She has put together some routine cards, some coping strategies under the character of Dr. Feelings. And we can squeeze in one last question, Dr. Elena. We've had many coming in on 4001. This is from anonymous listener saying, our 12-year-old daughter has always picked at her skin but is now pulling her hair out. Literally, no bald spot yet, but it's always in the same area. We try and gently remind her when we see her do it, but she gets very defensive. I don't want to nag, but this really concerns me and her mother. How best to tackle it? Is this anxiety related, and how would you recommend these parents proceed, Dr. Elena?
Okay, well, first of all, I definitely think that this is anxiety related, because quite often when we see this behavior, it is due to an inability to cope with a stress or worry, and it quite often is triggered by stress. Now, what's really important, especially when it comes to hair pulling, we have no bald spots yet, but it's really important to monitor that, because the symptoms sound like, if they are severe, sound like trichotillomania, which is a disorder where teenagers, usually, it's common among teenagers or preteens, start pulling out their hair. It can be on the head, but also in the eyebrows or any other part of the body, and basically this is a way for them to cope with severe stress that they are experiencing. And one of the most recommended techniques that has been shown to have good basically outlooks when it comes to trichotillomania is to actually go for cognitive behavioral therapy, meeting by a specialist in the field, a clinical psychologist, a child and adolescent psychologist, that can actually teach the child better coping skills and strategies to deal with that. So it is a form of anxiety, and it's quite common among teenagers or preteens. So it's important for us to make sure that we can rule out trichotillomania, or see whether it is purely a tic or purely a coping skill that is used to deal with the child's anxiety.
Dr. Elena, thank you so much for your answers and your insights this afternoon. Really, really appreciate it. You can be found on Instagram, as can Dr. Feelings, with those routine cards, those coping strategies. And to anyone out there who is worried, who we didn't get to today, Dr. Elena will be there on Instagram, take any questions and offer some insights there as well.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Turning our attentions to handwriting this hour, and the importance of good handwriting can be pretty easy to overlook in this digital age. Writing by hand is, of course, a really important skill for our children. It engages the brain in a really different way to that of typing. Studies show that writing improves memory, helps students retain information and new ideas as well, better than typing can. But a pandemic has a significant effect on our kids' fine motor skills. So what do you do if your child is struggling? And could it be an indication of a wider issue? Judith Wessels is with us this afternoon, occupational therapist. She's from South Africa, 35 years of experience, and is now practicing at Hope Habilitation Centre in Jumeirah. Judith, thank you so much for being with us today. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Now,
it's
a pleasure to have you with us. And as I said, 35 years of experience, a huge amount of time spent in clinic with patients as a paediatric specialist. We are looking at handwriting in particular today, and already lots of messages coming in on 4001. But I wondered, before we get to those, if you can explain a little bit about how children learn to write when they're really little, so we can get a better understanding of what happens in the brain and the body, affecting perhaps some children who may have difficulties later on.
I think you are asking a very important question, Helen, because development is quite an intricate process. And when it comes to handwriting, for example, it's almost like the end product of many stages of development. So, you know, we all know the brain is the hard drive of your whole body, or the main computer that drives all the activity that takes place. And usually we are very aware as parents of the gross motor skill development, of, you know, when the child starts to sit, starts to use both hands, starts to walk. So, of course, that is an important factor in the development of handwriting for later on, because we work everything back to the gross motor development, the development of your bigger muscle groups. The stronger your trunk becomes, the stronger you are able to maintain your head in an optimal position, the better you are enabled to first take weight on your hands, get different textures, exposure to different textures in your hands, and later on start to use your hands in a more functional way. And then, of course, the maturation of the brain is also a very individual thing, and the pace at which that takes place. There's sort of a global tempo, but some children might be a little bit slower in one area compared to other children. And then for occupational therapists, I like to think of it often as the sleeping partner. You know, parents are very aware of the gross motor development, even the fine motor. But your sensory system and the way in which you experience your own body and you interpret experiences, from the information you get from your sensory system, what it means to you and how you respond to the environment that's like a sleeping partner. That's not always so visible.
And I think it's so individual, as you say. We kind of shy away from the word normal as much as possible when we're talking about child development, but I think it's very difficult for parents not to compare their children's development in handwriting to other children they might see. I know when my daughter was doing posters around the school the other day, I was like, "Oh, they've got good handwriting," or "Oh, that's not so," you know. And it's one of these things that, you know, we shouldn't, but we can't help but compare like for like, because they can be put next to each other. And we've got lots of concerned parents on the text line for you, Judith, this afternoon. So we're going to get through as many questions as we can. And as I said, you can be anonymous if you want. No name on this message, saying our daughter is 3.5, is in FS1, can only write her name. She uses her left hand and right hand interchangeably, but almost always starts with her left. I'm leaving her for now, but is that okay? So she wrote her name the other day, but then didn't have a space, wrote a mirror image from the right. I think that's genius. What do you think? This little girl's 3.5 and is interchangeable. What do you think these parents need to be clued into, or is it all sounding good from your expert point of view?
I think the first thing, the fact that she's writing her name at the age of 3.5 is quite good. The fact that she's still using her hands interchangeably for 3.5 might also not be that much of a concern. The fact that she's writing the perfect mirror image is typical for her age. You know, we're talking there about positioning space and spatial relationships on a two-dimensional paper task, which is very different than building blocks. So the skill to copy, for example, letter and numbers is something that keeps on developing up to the age of around 5 and even beyond there. You will also, maybe some parents realized already that boys are often a bit more delayed than girls in that area at times. Another important thing is the question of whether midline crossing is fully developed, therefore the interchange between hands can also still happen. You know, it sounds at the moment, if it's still within the normal limits, I would like to know what the teacher is observing in the classroom, because as a therapist, I can never work in isolation. Mm. It's always important to know, yeah, how does the parents perceive and what does the teacher pick up? I think it's a beautiful age to start to look and ask the questions, because it's the right time to ask these questions.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line is occupational therapist Judith Wessels. More than 30 years of experience, and she's now practicing at Hope Habilitation Centre in Jumeirah. And I wish we had more time for this, Judith, because we've had many questions, many concerns. But I think this one from Lillian sums up one theme that has emerged on the text line. Lillian saying, my son is pretty intelligent, great with his schoolwork, but his writing is terrible. He tells me he finds it boring, which I understand. I've tried all sorts to get it better, but he gets really frustrated. Any ideas on how to improve the writing of a bored six-year-old, or will it just get better in time? I smiled when I saw that, Lillian, because yeah, my daughter is the same age and has, I think, the same frustrations. And I don't know what people come in to see you with on the most regular basis, but I'm sure kids and parents probably have quite different attitudes when it comes to the importance of handwriting, Judith. And I wondered if you had any advice for parents who are feeling similarly frustrated.
Yeah, I think the way you started this conversation by saying there is more to handwriting than just handwriting. It helps memory. It helps you to, it prepares the brain, for example, for reading. So now, yes, you do have a very intelligent child who has a poor handwriting, finds it boring. However, those are what we refer to as transferable skills. You know, working with a keyboard is just that. It's working with a keyboard. You're not integrating other parts of your brain like they could see in functional MRIs. So I think as parents, we must also remain curious about how we can engage our children in more fine motor activities, because it isn't a matter of either or in the electronic world. It is a matter of both. We have to learn how to deal with both. Mm-hmm. If it's really a concern, because for older children, what often happens, they cope well in the lower grades, but in, you know, like grade 3, 4, where the speed of work is getting faster, they often start to have fallout. But at that stage, it's a very big gap, mm-hmm, to go back and remediate old habit patterns of the way you approach. And we assume children will just know how to hold a pencil and do fine work. And for some, that is the case. For others, it's a bit more of an effort. And again, you know, it might also depend on your genetic predisposition. Some children are just better in fine motor and sports, and others are less. But we have to make sure the child is functional, mm-hmm, in task expectation. So earlier assessment via occupational therapy is quite a good idea when there is any doubt, because confidence, exactly, for children is a very worthy trait.
confidence in themselves and a parent having confidence in them as well. And when there is doubt or there's concerns, kids pick up on far more than we think they do. So Judith, as I said, can be found there at Hope Habilitation Centre in Jumeirah. I wish we had more time for the many questions, Judith. We'd love to have you back on the show. I know you're incredibly experienced across all sorts of different disciplines and interests. So thank you for your time this afternoon. Really, really appreciate it. And as I said, if you do have any concerns, please don't let those hang over you. Go to speak to an expert, occupational therapist, educational psychologist. There are lots of people here in Dubai who are on hand to help.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're going to the great outdoors now, and last year was an incredibly tough year. It forced many of us to adapt in so, so many ways, from how we work to what we eat and basically how we now live. One thing that was really hard to ignore, though, was the disruption to our food systems. The pandemic highlighted just how vulnerable those processes are. In fact, so many people turned to their own gardens, started growing their own food to become self-sufficient. One company who's helping the UAE with this is Emirates Biopharm. Joining us now is Operations Manager Yazin Al-Qadmani. Yazin, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. For anyone who's not familiar, who hasn't been to your beautiful green corner of the UAE, can you explain exactly what happens at Emirates Biopharm? Paint us a picture.
Sure. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Emirates Biopharm is the UAE's largest organic farm, and we have become one of the key destinations for agritourism. So we set up farm tours where you get to experience going around the farm on a tractor, getting down and harvesting, and then seeing outdoor agriculture, indoor agriculture, visiting our greenhouses. So it's educational and fun.
And you're growing produce as well, of course. What can you tell us a little bit about what you grow and how the UAE can be helpful in the growing and perhaps climate-wise not so helpful? How is your garden growing right now?
So in terms of, yeah, in terms of our farm, our main business is wholesale into most of the major retailers like Carrefour and Spinneys and Lulu and Kitchens as well. In terms of the weather, we actually have really good growing conditions 6 months of the year. So in the wintertime, we have excellent, stable weather. We have sunlight. So all of these things are positive. The main challenges we have are, of course, water availability and the quality and soil. But when it comes to soil, a lot of people are coming to realize that, you know, if you've heard of hydroponics, you know that the plants can grow without soil. So the desert sand is actually a good substrate for us to add in our organic fertilizers and grow well. So that's an issue that we can overcome.
And what is growing well now for any budding gardeners out there? And I know it's half term, lots of kids thinking about, you know, as you say, taking advantage of this growing season. What is a bit of a fail-safe hit for easy growing fruit and veggies right now?
Well, right now you can grow anything and everything in the UAE. There's a few things that are always the easiest. Of course, if you're going to do, you can't go wrong with herbs, with parsley, coriander, mint. These things are very straightforward, easy, fast-growing. The fun things that kids love, I think, is carrots, but they would take a bit more care and time. And then a bit more involved would be growing tomatoes and cucumbers and maybe beans and peppers. But the thing is, people need to know that we fail, everyone fails. So you just get started. It's not about, you know, how much did I produce or did the plant die. It's about the journey with the kids, especially.
I think it's a really interesting point that things are actually starting to grow here and technology is playing a huge part in that, because 80%, give or take, of our food here in the UAE is still imported. But great to see people buying more locally, growing themselves. What kind of patterns do you expect to see over the next 5 to 10 years, Yazin, when it comes to more produce being grown right here?
Well, the UAE has, you know, limited resources when it comes to water and soil. So I think we shouldn't be growing mass commercial crops. I think the main direction that the UAE is heading towards is the high-value, high quality products that come from organic agriculture or from high-tech closed environment agriculture. And with the high-tech closed environment agriculture, the benefits are saving water and being able to produce year-round very high quality, you know, compared to any production, the European production. And when it comes to organic, it fills the gap because the closed environment stuff is limited. It can grow lettuces and tomatoes mainly, and that's what we see on the supermarket shelves. But the world of agriculture is very big, right? So we have the root crops, the carrots, the beets, and potatoes, and then you have outdoor crops like eggplants and corn and so many other things. You know, they're countless. And then you have animal agriculture like poultry and eggs, milk, organic milk. So organic really encompasses the entire food system and agriculture system, also fruit trees and different things. So I think there's going to be growth in organic. This is what the consumer is demanding, and you see it in the supermarkets. Those sections are ever expanding. And then, of course, the high-tech players are coming in to replace all this import that the UAE brings in.
Before I let you get back to your growing season and the preparations for those tours starting up again, a question from Fatima saying, if someone's a total beginner, what would your top tip be for growing food in the UAE? Great question, Fatima, and something I need some advice on as well. So making sure you have a successful crop at home, what would your number one tip be, Yasin?
Well, the number one thing, you know, a lot of people would send me a plant that looks very sad. It has multiple pests on it. It has, and they go online and they try to analyze the leaf and say this is a calcium deficiency or this or that. And usually the why we are successful is just starting correctly. So if you're able to look online, we have on our own website, emiratesbiofarm.com, we have Emirates Biofarm Academy. And it has, you know, how to start your garden. It has the calendars. It has how to prepare the soil, whether you're growing in pots or outdoors. So it has all those details. If you start correctly, like on the farm, you start in what we would call a nursery. So it's a protected environment and nice clean soil. And we start the seeds. So in your house, it could be indoors. And then you transfer them outside into proper, nice sand. The plant is strong enough to handle the pests and different things, you know, the issues would become much, much less. So I think you should start with just figuring out how to make proper soil instead of planting. I see a lot of gardens in Dubai, they have rocks and salty sand and stuff that's not suitable. So just changing that out, getting some compost, some potting soil, some red sand, they call it sweet sand, and mixing it in makes a world of difference. And then just let the, you know, experiment and let the plants die and try
and
again.
Okay
and plants, yeah, be okay with it. Those Instagram accounts that are showing you some beautiful plants, they probably had 50 sales before they had the nice ones to show you. So that's just part of the process.
Very smart indeed, Yasin. Thank you so much. All the best to you and the team. And another question as well from Megan saying, when are the tours starting again? And I know they're incredibly popular with kids, as you said, going around on tractors, seeing what's been happening in the fields. When are those tours up and running for this cooler season?
So because we're based between Dubai and Al Ain, we were on the Abu Dhabi side, we have been closed to guests for the past year and a half with the COVID regulations and pandemic, especially that we're in food systems. But we are planning to open up on the 15th of November, so in a month. And please check our social media pages. We will post more information closer to the date.
Yasin, really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
We are Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We love celebrating young people who are doing something special. Joining us on the line now is Viha. She's a teenager aiming to bring some awareness to a rare disease that her uncle has suffered from all of his life. She's just 16 years old and joining us to tell us more. Viha, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Helen. How are you?
I am well, thank you. Are you on half term this week as well?
Yeah, I am. I deserve this break. It was a very stressful start to the year.
I think a lot of people feel exactly the same. But you strike me as someone who perhaps doesn't rest and relax that easily. Always got something to do and something on your mind. Tell us a little bit about yourselves. What are you studying and where?
So I'm a student at Dubai College. I'm in year 12 and I'm currently doing A-levels where I'm pursuing math, further math, English literature and economics.
Wow. With a view to doing what? What are you thinking for university?
Oh, that's a really hard decision, but I'm probably going to be doing something related to econ, definitely because of my uncle's influences, which I'll talk about in a bit.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Well, please enjoy the break. I think a lot of teachers have had a tough start as well. You've also got a passion as something of an entrepreneur, especially with that charitable angle in mind. Tell us a little bit about your uncle.
So my uncle, I could talk for hours about him, but he is a man who's been struck with an extremely rare disease, meningomyelitis, which I don't think anyone's heard of.
Never.
At the age of 8. And I think there's been like one human apart from him who's gotten it. And despite traveling from pillar to post, he wasn't able to find a cause or a cure when he was that age. And despite that, he went on to become the top self-taught higher economics teacher in Kolkata, and he founded an NGO with over 10,000 followers.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about the condition and what that's kind of meant over the years in terms of his abilities, physical and otherwise?
Yeah, so this condition means that he's been paralyzed from the neck below, and he's known as the man who's been quarantined for 40 years, and he's been confined to his bed for like that long. And despite that, you know, he has this like lifelong hunger for knowledge, hunger for learning things, which he's gone on to pursue through starting his educational social enterprise NGO and becoming a teacher.
Unbelievable. And this has obviously captured your heart and your imagination, and you're now producing a documentary about us. Tell us what you're hoping to highlight and hoping to achieve by this piece of work.
So this documentary would be sort of a biographical look at his empowering struggle. And I think the end goal of this documentary is mainly to raise awareness of the rarity of his disease, but also to inspire children, especially my age, who because at that age, it would be very easy for him to fall into some kind of, depression or mental illness. But he remained positive. He pulled himself out of it. And went on to become, something I so many people look up to. So I think that empowering struggle is something I want to inspire and bring to the audiences.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you're making the documentary? Is this all you? How are you learning the skills? Is there anyone you've brought on board to help you bring it to life?
Well, this whole thing is written, shot and produced by me. And honestly, it was a very, very difficult task at first because, as you may know, filmmaking is a very, very big, complex process. Mm-hmm. So I had to write the script. It went through multiple iterations. But now it's in the editing process and I'm using Hale Education Services to, help market it and help push it to the potential it can, because the end goal is to sort of get it into film festivals and use it to raise money for a disability organization through the viewing sales.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on the line now is Biha Kadia. She is 16 years old and is making a documentary to highlight a disease suffered by her uncle, paralysed since the age of 8. It has not stopped him carving an incredible career as a teacher and philanthropist. And Biha is there on a mission to not only raise awareness, but to hopefully appear in some film festivals too. Can I ask you, Biha, what did your uncle think about being part of this project?
He is extremely camera shy, I must say. He wasn't too pleased about this at all. And it took quite a lot of persuading at the beginning to let me spread his story. And he is usually quite shy about this. But in the end, once I told him the end goal, he did understand the purpose of this and was, reluctantly agreed.
So obviously you need to be speaking to him and getting an understanding. I think that's actually an incredible opportunity. When someone asked me recently if I could interview anyone, who would I want to interview? And I had to really think about it, because your mind automatically goes to, famous people who've done something amazing or done something terrible. But I actually think interviewing relatives that I've never really had the chance to get to know would be the most fascinating, because you don't get that opportunity again. I wish I could sit down with my grandma and ask questions about her life growing up and because we don't tend to have these big important conversations day to day with family. It's just about, you know, dinner and occasions and the kind of the small details of life. What were some of the things you took from your conversations with your uncle that are really going to stay with you, Biha?
I would say definitely it's the fact that he never once relied on his parents or his siblings for anything, whether it be something as simple as opening the door handle when he was home alone or switching on the lights or going to the bathroom. He didn't rely on anyone despite his physical shortcomings. And that just stuck with me because right now I constantly pester my mom to like make me something to eat or take me out or something. But he never once complained. He never once asked them for help. It was all his own determination, his own will. And that's something that I want to replicate in the future.
He sounds like an amazing man. It sounds like it's going to be an incredible project as well. How can we follow you and support you on this?
Well, I have a Facebook page, and the current title, working title of the documentary is The Walk Alone, based on an old Bengali adage. And I'd be happy if you guys could just have a follow on that, and we'll keep you updated about, you know, updates on what's going on with the documentary and where it's going.
Well, huge congratulations in advance. I think it takes a really special person to look at a story like this and want to share it with others. So thank you to you and your uncle, of course. Please do keep us updated. I can tell by the tone in your voice you're going places. So I could be this year Dubai, next year Cannes. Please, please, please keep us updated. I really, really appreciate your time this afternoon. And as I said, if there's someone out there that you think deserves to have some time in spotlight, as we celebrated here on Dubai Eye. It could be a child, it could be a teen, someone who's doing something special academically or through charity, through creativity. Please let me know, 4001. We'd love to hear from you.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It is Sunday when we talk about children's health, education, parenting. And I'm curious, as a child, were you ever told not to play with a certain toy because of your gender? Breaking all the rules on the show this afternoon, recently had a chat with the team from Lego. Warning, I did do this interview while distance learning with my kids.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking about play with purpose today, and according to Lego's Play Well report, research suggests that 78% of parents globally say that they treat kids differently based on their gender, and nearly 70% prefer kids to play with toys associated stereotypically with their gender. So how about you and your kids? Let us know on 4001. As part of its efforts to inspire more girls to take interest in STEM through play, Lego Middle East has launched its Girls Are Ready global campaign right here in the UAE. Telling us more, we've got Ursula Baganska from Lego MEA. Tell us a little bit more. Thank you for joining us today, Ursula. Now, I don't need any convincing. As you know, me and my kids are Lego mad. But I think it's a really good opportunity to talk about the aims of this campaign. Who do you want to connect with Girls Are Ready?
Thank you for having me here, first of all. And yes, I think it's we continue to crack this challenge. I think it's something that we have noticed already some time ago. And also, especially here in Middle East, we have noticed that indeed the parents treat boys and girls quite differently when it comes to STEM education. So when it comes to science, math, technology classes. And right now, more and more data are kind of confirming that. Parents are three times more likely to encourage boys to join coding classes, to pick up some of those really core 21st century skills than they are to encourage girls to do the same. And this is why we're trying to connect with the parents here in the Middle East and in UAE specifically, where, you know, digitalization and technology is so high on the agenda and so many jobs in that sector actually need filling, that we need the girls to also pick up those topics and be encouraged to join those classes as of early age, actually, you know. And so this is something that we have in our heart and mind starting this campaign with amazing role model. We have on board Fatima Al-Kabi. She's one of the youngest Emirati inventors, and she has won multiple awards for her wonderful inventions, such as Braille machine. She also was very forward-looking because when she was just 12, she invented a robot that would go to school instead of kids if they were sick, who would know that COVID era would come? So she's absolutely amazing brain right now. She's studying in the US, of course, technology and engineering. And she always has been doing her prototypes of her inventions using Lego bricks. So she's very natural role model for girls here in the region.
She also has a younger sister who's really passionate about space, yes, as well. Tell us about her.
Yes, Shaika is amazing. She's absolutely incredible, similarly to her sister, and treating her sister as an idol and as an absolute role model. And that only shows that importance, right? If you see already girls in the field, if you see that it's possible, then any girl can get confidence that that it's also possible for them. So Shaika indeed is an incredible young girl who, together with her sister, build a space rover fully out of Lego bricks and Lego Mindstorm system. And we actually worked on this together with the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center. And with that, they actually have their robot supervised and checked by the astronauts. And we do hope that one day it will go with them to the mission to Mars.
I have no doubt it will, Ursula. I want to ask you about the name, though. Girls Are Ready. I think girls have been ready for an awfully long time. So who do you think is not ready to be coming on board with you, whether that is to Mars or to more STEM classes?
Absolutely. And I think that this is exactly what we are trying to say with this campaign, that girls have been ready all along. It's mostly the parents or the adults that have been having doubts about this. And that is something that we need to start realizing and addressing stronger and stronger. That this is us who limit girls' creativity and power rather than the girls themselves, because the statistics that we also discussed in the beginning, those are adult statistics. If you ask kids, they will tell you that they can play whatever they want and they don't mind. Mm-hmm. But it's really the parents that are, or the gift givers or whoever is teachers, right? I mean, when I was a little girl, I was also really in love with math. And that was always something that I heard from the teachers, that it's almost unnatural that a girl is so good in mathematics. And every teacher that would approach me was surprised by this. So what do you get as a girl when you hear that? You feel odd, or you feel mirrored, you feel almost like an imposter. Like, what's wrong with me that I'm actually good with that? And should I be busy with something else rather than spend my time on math? So this is something that we want to really address and talk about, that girls are ready all along. Is just the world that needs to catch up.
And can I ask you a little bit about what kind of buying patterns you've noticed with various Lego sets and collections resonating with different genders, or, as you say, people buying them for girls or boys?
It's very interesting, because indeed sometimes I am asked about this, whether whether we as the Lego group kind of also are biased or offer different offering towards girls and boys. And in reality, we don't. We have all types of play and passion points. So you have the house play, but also, of course, technology play and robotics and other elements of it, and adventure play and different properties like Harry Potter's and the superheroes. You know, it's a rainbow on the shelf. And then it's up to you to choose when you approach that shelf. So what we have seen, and honestly, sometimes I see it myself in the store, when a girl is reaching out for a box, and then this is the parent taking out this from her hands, saying like, can you go and pick up something more girly for yourself? If a girl picks up a set with pirates or a set with robots, that's sometimes the feedback that she hears from the parent that is with her buying that. And that's something also that we see then bias in terms of the person who is actually spending the money or paying for the product. That's the parent or a gift giver, right? That would be a bit trying to steer the child towards the interests that they think are proper, rather than the child choosing it for themselves.
So can I ask you, when it comes to representing girls and boys in your advertisements, what kind of conscious or subconscious decisions do you think you've made in the past, and what's it look like today?
I am a very big advocate of diversity and inclusion, and that does not only cover, you know, the casting that we do for our advertisement, but it also has to cover, you know, everything that stands behind it: production, the amount of women that work on it, the amount of women behind the camera. You know, the woman is not only the makeup artist on the set, she can be the director, she can be coordinating the lights. So I think it's important on so many levels, actually, when you as a as any company, kind of carry that responsibility to think about this, not only in the casting and how you project yourself, but also in the other areas. In the Lego advertisement, we started taking far more conscious decisions also globally on that, on how we include girls and boys in a different setups in the advertisement, but also children with disabilities, children of determination. So to make sure that each child is represented as having the right to play. So our recent advertisement really, since 2 or 3 years especially, covers all spectrum of different children to show that every child has an equal right to play.
Thank you so, so much. As you said, the Girls Are Ready campaign has launched. You can see some incredible young women really leading the way. And I'm a firm believer that you can't be it unless you see it. Have a great day ahead. Take care.
Thank you. And good luck with your homeschooling.
Thank you.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.